Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial.
Fitch takes a hard line on Greece. Italy is downgraded, and the tech and retailers are their biggest losers. This is Andrew Horowitz. Welcome to episode number 213 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All the way at the end of May, only 1 week to wrap up the month of May, and we're still considering whether or not the adage of sell in May and go away makes any sense. So far, yes, sirree, it does. The bottom line is that there has been some gasping moves to the upside, and there's been some pretty ugly moves to the downside. Although, if you haven't noticed, markets haven't been really affected as much as you would see some of the sectors and individual securities. We've seen the massive rotation into the defensive sector, which consists of healthcare and consumer staples, maybe telecom. And at the same time, an incredible move out of the more growth-oriented sectors, right? We've seen a big move out of tech, retailers, some services. This is all part of what's going on in the minds of this rotation process when mutual fund managers and hedge fund managers still want to be invested in the markets, but maybe not to the degree where they can see some real downside pressure. We're going to get to all that. Also, we have guests. We have John Perkins, who is the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We've had him on a couple of years ago, and I thought it was a really good time to bring him back to find out if any of the things that are going on in the world right now have anything, wink, wink, to do with the oil and how the U.S. involvement in that is playing out. We also have with us for that interview John C. Dvorak, who you know I do the DH Unplugged podcast with. And when I told him that we had John Perkins coming on, he said, can you get me on? I said, sure. Come on, he has some great questions to ask, he told me, so we'll get to that in a minute. What I thought we'd do is start out with some of the basic things that are going on, and then we'll just have a short opening today and an entry into this discussion. We'll bring in, we'll hook into a, call them up and get a discussion going with John and John. And then on the other side of that, what I thought we would do is get into some of the things that we're seeing right now in the market that are interesting, maybe involving the whole area of LinkedIn and earnings and, what's happening with the actual markets, the corrective mode that we're seeing, and maybe not only what we could do about it, but how to recognize some of that and to see if that's going to change. So next week, we do have Jack Schwager coming on. We have, he's written, you know him, right? We had him on once before. He has a couple of books, and one in particular, Market Wizards, that is an interview style. I guess that's the best way to describe it. It's an interview style book that talks to and with many of the masters of the investment markets, the guys who have year in and year out, and primarily historically. I mean, these are older names, the names that you'll know, like Peter Lynch or maybe even Jim Rogers or, Fisher. I mean, just the names that are synonymous with the investment industry. And he interviewed them, talked with them, and then kind of gave you a flavor of what is it that makes them successful. He has a few other books as well, but I thought that was something that we could really enjoy, just kind of coming back to basics, coming back to, okay, what makes a successful investor? Now, mind you, a successful investor is not successful all the time. There are going to be those times that you take some serious lumps, right? There's going to be those times that you get hurt in the markets. You can't help that. You can try, but you can't help that. That's the truth. No professional, no hedge fund, no individual, not even the luckiest person on earth who has been investing for a very long time has not lost money. Because sometimes you have to lose money to make money. It's the way it is. So don't beat yourself up if maybe you picked the wrong position, the wrong sector, you entered the wrong time. But do kick yourself if you've made the mistake of holding on too long, right? So you hoped and prayed that it would come back. You didn't use good sell or buy disciplines. And maybe you acted inappropriately. Now, I'll tell you something. This market's moving fast. The individual positions are moving very quickly. So if you used something like, I don't know, a 5% stop loss as your maximum downside risk, you probably got stopped out pretty easily. Over the last 3 weeks, you've seen moves of 5% a day in stocks all over the place, up and down. So one of the things you want to do maybe in this market is reconsider some of the size limits that you have on your stops, but also realize that maybe taking profits a little bit earlier would make sense, right? Because when we're in a corrective market, there's a lot of selling going on, and even good earnings and even good stories and upgrades are not going to help generally. Maybe you want to hedge your portfolio, put some sell stops, or at least write down your stop levels on certain stocks. If they break the rule that you put down for yourself, whether they break the 50-day line, whether they break support, whether they are down more than 5%, 7%, 10%, whatever that rule is, hey, you know, it's time to sell. And if it moves back, you can get back into it when the markets are more agreeable. At the same time, if a stock moves up nicely, look at what happened with Fossil recently. We talked about that we owned a nice piece, a large piece in our portfolio. For us, it's about a 6% or I think it was a 7% position in the portfolio. And then the profit EPS came out, it skyrocketed 8 or 9%. And you know what? We took some off the table. It was the right thing to do. It's fallen back about 3% since. So you know what? Okay, we have a nice cushion now. Anyway, we're going to talk about that when we get back to the discussion I'm going to have with you. But I thought maybe we would start out earlier today. Before we get into that, and I have lots to talk to you about after we get back from the discussion and this conference call we're going to get into with John Perkins and John C. Dvorak. And I know I've been promising this for a while. So I think that these two gentlemen will make a good discussion, and hopefully you'll enjoy some of the things that I have in my mind to ask, you know, in terms of, you know, what are the connections here? Is the U.S. involved in Libya because of what? You know, why aren't we somewhere else? I mean, I have all these things that I've written down that I want to ask him. So, well, let's get to that. All right, we're here with, we've talked about this for a while, and we're here with my good friend John C. Dvorak because he really wanted in on this conversation, and John Perkins. John Perkins, of course, you know him as the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, also Hoodwinked, and someone who we've had on before. How are you, John Perkins?
I'm great, thank you. Good to be with you.
Thanks. You've been doing a lot of things, I know, and you've been traveling around, and but I really want to focus in on a few things. I got to be honest with you. Since the last time we've talked, I got so many emails in. I have a nagging question that I feel you're the perfect person to answer. I think, at least. I have a big buildup there, huh? So
it's a big buildup. Yes.
So, the last go round of U.S. involvement in the Middle East due to an item was this whole Libyan, well, we're deeply involved in now, but yet there's so many countries around the world and places around the world that there's all this terrible hardship going on. Why is it that we are so involved with Libya? Does it have to do with this whole undercurrent of what you've written about oil and all that?
Well, I think it really has to do more with currency and the banking system. Libya only produces something like 2% of the world's oil. So it's probably not really about oil, although oil is a factor. But Gaddafi has a central bank that owns a tremendous amount of gold, and it's a very independent central bank. It's not tied in with the rest of the central banks. It's not in the European central banks or the Federal Reserve. That's always been a sore point for us. And in the months leading up to the invasion of Libya, he was making a lot of waves about organizing the Muslim and African countries to sell oil for a new currency that he calls the gold dinar, and that's a huge threat to the U.S. dollar, and it's a threat to the central banking system that we're so dependent upon. Saddam Hussein suggested something before he was thrown out, and the mullahs in Iran suggested something about the time when we talked seriously about invading them. So we don't like to see our currency system or our central banking system threatened. So I have a feeling that a lot of what's going on in Libya is about that. It's also just a plain show of force of the United States in the Middle East, which, as you said, has become very, very crucial. We want to make sure that places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Syria and Tunisia and the other countries don't get taken over or run by radical Muslim groups.
Yeah.
So what we call that.
Now, before I know, John Dvorak has some questions. Is this current administration different than the administration that you knew when you were writing about things like Confessions of an Economic Hitman and all that? Is that all still going on? Is it maybe, it doesn't matter what the administration is, it's all the background thing that goes on as an undercurrent of us as the United States, or are things different?
Well, I think it's, by this administration, you mean the United States administration,
yeah.
The Obama administration?
Yeah, Obama. I'll say Obama because, you know, the rest of it's kind of the same.
Yeah. Well, I think the fact of the matter is, and what I write about in Hoodwinked a lot, is that today, the geopolitics of the world is controlled by big corporations, what I call the corporatocracy. The U.S. government and every other major government is there to help support us. So, and including the CIA and the U.S. military, they're really backing the big corporate interests. And in a way, the President of the United States is not very powerful these days. I think we've really seen that with Obama, you know, a guy that started off by saying he wasn't going to accept any money from corporations, ended up accepting a lot of money from corporations.
All the money from the corporation. Right.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And of course, so did McCain. So the corporations were financing both of them. So whoever won would end up putting people from Wall Street in charge of of the government's financial policies, and people from Monsanto and the other big agribusinesses in charge of our agricultural policy, and so on and so forth. So it's big corporations, and we talk about the Obama administration versus the McCain possibility or the Bush administration or perhaps Sarah Palin or whoever, but the fact of the matter is they all essentially report to the corporatocracy. And let's face it, presidents are extremely vulnerable these days. In Kennedy's day, you had to take a president out with a bullet. But today, you can do it through innuendo, rumor, skeletons in the closet, the things like we've been seeing recently with the head of the IMF. You can bring a man down very easily. And I'm not defending the head of the IMF at all, but I'm saying that it's very easy to take power away from a person without actually killing them.
Yeah, I could attest that. John Dvorak, what do you have? I know there's a lot of things you want to ask.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of the Economic Hitman book, and the follow-up movie I thought was good, too. And I specifically like the kind of the recommendations you had in terms of dealing with how to analyze stories that were you could put in the end of that book. And you know, there's a couple of questions that always came up with while paying attention to that book, which is, are there any other countries that use the techniques that you describe in the Economic Hitman book? In other words, are there economic hitmen from, let's say, China or Russia or any place?
Yes, increasingly so, but there is a major difference. And that is that, as I point out in the book, when the economic hitmen fail from the United States, we send in what we call the jackals to either overthrow governments or assassinate the leaders. And if that doesn't work, as with Saddam Hussein, then we send in the military. So there's no other country in the world today that has that capacity to the level that we do all three of those things. So there are certainly other economic hitmen working for these other countries, and there are economic hitmen working for big corporations. So Monsanto has their own version, and Nike has their own version, and all the oil companies have their own version. But a major difference is that the United States also has the CIA. We have a huge stable of jackals, and, you know, part of what goes on in drug cultures in places like Colombia and Mexico is that a lot of those people are connected to us, and we can draw on them if we need to take somebody out in Latin America. The same is true around the world. The CIA has very long arms. It's not just the CIA. It's the NSA. It's the whole intelligence establishment in the United States, which no other country has anything to compare with that, or with our military muscle. So we do stand out in that regard. But let's never forget that all of those, and including the economic hitmen who come out of China or who come out of Russia or any other country, are basically these days working for the corporations, the corporatocracy, not so much for governments. The governments are pawns of the big corporations, and I think that's an essential fact that we need to understand, because if we're going to combat the system, we've got to understand the true nature of the system.
Well, I think that, that's, yeah, I can accept that. But one of the things, about, especially with this Libyan situation, what I was finding in some research is that, you know, the kind of the undertold story, especially in American media, is the incursion of China. And this has been going on for a while into Africa and you know, doing deals with these governments, not turning a blind eye to human rights issues and getting sweet deal contracts and then trying to get anything they can out of Africa. And I know that they were working with Libya and Egypt and just about everybody, actually. And it seems to me there's some backlash against China. What is China? Because they obviously have their own schemes of raping, parts of the world for their own purposes. What kind of approach do they take? Do you have any kind of feeling for what the Chinese do?
I do. I was in China fairly recently. I was a keynote speaker at a huge conference there of MBA students and good government officials, et cetera. And I also just spent some time hanging out with them, eating good Chinese food and drinking beer with them. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very impressed with is about China is the fact that China's economic growth has been pretty much fired by us and by the big multinational corporations. We're the market. And so China is very closely tied to corporate policies. Now, corporations don't want us to really understand that, but the truth of the matter is, without the big multinational corporations, China's economy would not be what it is today, and they're very dependent on that. And if you take China in other countries, certainly China is doing a lot to make inroads in Latin America, in Africa, in Middle East, in many places. I have a lot of friends in high positions in governments in Latin America, and I speak Spanish fluently. I spend a lot of time there. And one of the things that they point out to me is that the Chinese, to them, are much less threatening and easier to get along with, in many respects, than the United States or the World Bank, because the Chinese, when they give loans, when they make concessions, when they strike deals, they don't have the conditionalities attached. They don't have all the requirements attached that these countries sell their water systems or their electric utilities to Chinese corporations. And the biggest thing of all, China has no military presence in any of these other parts of the world and never has. And we do. And that's very scary to a lot of leaders, a lot of countries. Our tremendous military presence that makes us look like bullies. So in a way today, China is perceived as a much more benign partner or potential partner.
Well, you know, the thing is, when we look around the world, though, it does seem like, you know, that there is the continuation of, you know, so much of raping and pillaging of third world nations. I know you're very involved in this, and it seems like, you know, it just always gets back to the whole area of materials. And I know that's also a passion of yours, of making sure that, you know, the natural resources of countries aren't abused, right? So
Yeah.
But what's happening now? Are these countries, are we seeing at least some of the third world countries being able to grow due to the better level of income they may be getting from the natural resources? Or is all of it just simply the governments and they'll, you know, let them eat cake kind of concept?
Well, no, we're seeing in many of these countries now a huge grassroots movement to protect resources, to protect the people. We've seen 10 countries in Latin America in less than the last decade vote in democratic elections presidents who are standing up to the corporations to varying degrees. And they all realize they're vulnerable, so they have to be careful. And incidentally, every one of these 10 countries that democratically voted in these presidents recently Every one of these 10 countries during most of my lifetime was run by brutal dictators, primarily put into control by into power by the CIA and kept there by CIA operatives. That's all changed. So Latin America's had this revolution, and yet every one of those leaders, take Rafael Correa, very enlightened president of Ecuador, democratically elected in two elections, and he has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He's very savvy about capitalism, about our system, and he's standing up to the corporations. But we tried to overthrow him in a coup less than a year ago, and that followed a successful coup that did overthrow the president of Honduras, Zelaya, because he went up against Dole and Takeda, Russell's Athletic, and several other U.S. corporations. When Rafael Correa did something similar, we all tried to overthrow him, but he knew our system well enough that he was able to withstand the coup attempt. He stayed in power much as Hugo Chavez had in Venezuela. But it also made him aware that he needs to make more compromises so that this won't happen to him. So there is this struggle we're seeing in Latin America, a grassroots movement toward much greater democracy, toward saying to the corporations, look, we know that in order to extract our oil or our copper or whatever, we need the help of big corporations with the technology to do it, but you've got to pay a much fairer share back to our people, and you've got to protect the environment when you're doing it. You've got to use the same standards that you use in your own country. And we're seeing that increasingly. And I think a lot of what's going on in the Middle East on a grassroots level is also the people trying to make that happen in the Middle East. But there's been this huge backlash in the Middle East, where the United States has a much stronger military presence than we do in Latin America, and the ability to use it more in the Middle East because of a long history. So we are seeing this movement across the world. We're seeing it in China, too. The young people of China are really talking incredibly about becoming greener, becoming more environmentally and socially responsible. I heard this over and over again in China. We're seeing it in the United States with our teachers and sort of a resurgence of union activism on the part of teachers and government employees. So it's happening. But as it happens, the corporatocracy, the status quo, digs in even stronger.
Well, I mean, at the same time, you know, John Perkins, this is going to sound very cold and callous, and I apologize in advance. You know, the question is, can we all live in the world at the same level of whether it's success of nourishment? I mean, is there even though we are a higher animal with brain power, is there a simple survival of the fittest with going on? I mean, look at all the people in China. I mean, it's in India, and I mean, 25% of the world is in India and China alone, right? So,
yeah.
I mean,
a third of the world, yeah.
So, I mean, what is the story with the food with? I mean, is this the outbreaks in Egypt all initiated? One of the big things in Tunisia was the wheat prices, right?
Right,
And they've gone up, and they've gone up again. And do we have any belief that that's going to stop if we have to keep on, for whatever reason, utilizing wheat for a food product in those countries?
Yeah, or utilizing, overutilizing wheat for many different things in the United States. You know, the population is obviously an issue, and at some point we have to stop population growth at these outrageous rates. But the other fact is that less than 5% of us live in the United States, and we consume almost 30% of the world's resources. So right there, that tells you, and so much of our consumption is for military purposes. You know, huge part of our budget is military. And another huge part of our consumption is essentially trinkets, things we don't need.
Right.
And if you think of how we might redistribute these resources so that rather than spending all this money on the military and trinkets, are we really focused on making sure that nobody starves in the world? Nobody goes without food, without clothes or shelter. We could create a very different world. And yes, I think it's extremely possible. But we, the people, have to make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm no ideologue who says it's just going to happen. You know, here it is. We've got to make it happen. And we've got to realize that these big corporations are calling these shots, and yet they are very dependent on us. And none of the corporations can survive and thrive unless we buy from them. And we have to understand that the marketplace is a democracy. When you buy something and choose not to, you're casting a vote. And for way too long, we sent the message to the corporations that, look, I want cheap tennis shoes. Mm-hmm. And if that means slaves working in sweatshops in Indonesia, I'll just look the other way. I want cheap petroleum for my car, and if that means destroying the Amazon rainforest, I'll just look the other way. We sent this message out, and we're still sending this message out. And as we have to change that. We have to understand that for our children and grandchildren to grow up in a sane world, a sustainable, a just world, every child on the planet has to have that, and that's new.
I hear you.
All we have to do is worry about the United States. Now we got to worry about the whole planet.
Yeah,
because
but
it's so integrated.
John Dvorak, I don't think it's, honestly, I don't mean to start a whole discussion here. I hear you. It sounds great, John Perkins, but you know what? I don't have faith that that's ever going to happen, unfortunately. I'm sorry. Practically, Dvorak, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't have any complaints about that sort of goal. And whether it happens or not is dependent on way too many variables for me to figure out. And a lot of it has to do with nothing more than just distribution issues. I mean, there's probably, I mean, like somebody did a calculation of the population, said you could fit everybody. Of course, it'd be, I don't know how cramped it would be, but it wouldn't be that cramped. You could fit everybody in the entire world into the state of Texas. But then the problem would be to get all the resources of the world into the state of Texas to feed them. That's not a possibility. I think a lot of this is logistics, to be honest about it. I think half of this stuff could be done now if we had better distribution systems around the world. I mean, it's not like we don't throw a lot of food away.
You know what I think it is? I think it's a mindset, and it has to do with our economic theory. So when I was going to business school in the 60s, late 60s, I was taught that when you become a CEO, you take responsibility for your suppliers, your customers, your employees, and the communities where you work. Your business has to be a good community citizen. This was drummed into us. That all changed. That was Keynesian economics. That changed when Milton Friedman came along, the Chicago School of Economics, and was totally accepted by Reagan and Thatcher and Odson, and incidentally by every president of the United States since, including Democrat and Republican alike, have bought in to Milton Friedman's form of economics, which says that the only responsibility of the CEO is to maximize profits, regardless of the social and environmental cost. To hell with the community, to hell with the employees, to hell with the suppliers and the customers, maximize profits. And that has been the single biggest problem, I think, in as corporations have become more and more powerful, and that has been the driving force. We've seen ourselves going deeper and deeper into a failed system globally. And so I think the mindset, you know, if we can just change that mindset and to realize that the corporations are dependent on us, they're run by people like you and me, the managers, and just let's turn that around and say the driving force behind corporations should be to be good public servants, should serve the public, make profits, pay a decent rate of return to your investors, because that's the only way you're going to get investors, but also be socially and environmentally conscious. Have a standard that says we're going to make profits, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, peaceful world that's thriving for all people. If we just set that goal and we only buy from corporations that are committed to that goal, we'll get there.
Well, you know, first of all, I think it's a little debatable that Democrats and Republicans and everybody buy into the whatever Milton Friedman's thesis basically is, and to blame him is kind of a bit off the wall since he's an academic. I think that if you take a look at the basis for all this, besides the business school environment, which grinds out these people, is to take where's the ethics courses that used to be taught in high school, social studies? I mean, I would take a look at the education system, and rather than blame one theory or one man's approach to economics, and take a look at what's happened to the education system, where you're grinding out a bunch of dumb drones who have they learn nothing in high school or grammar school, for that matter. They have books that are propaganda that are fed to them. And they come out, then they can't think for themselves. I think that's a bigger issue than one economic approach.
I think Perkins, I think you're talking about a bigger picture here, too. And I agree with you, John. You know, one of the things is, and I know we're a little bit limited on time, but one of the things that I've noticed is that, you know, with my kids, they're learning how to take tests rather than think. You know, learning how to react to something rather than research, understand, put things together. It's kind of like, you know, what is the point of what you're doing to be, like you said, you know, a robotic, you know, just a robotic, you know, test taker that won't actually provide any kind of utility for the world. And that's just silly because That you could be a simple line worker to learn something like that. But the school system, I do agree that there is something horribly wrong with it. Let me just say something else. I live in a relatively affluent area in Florida. I just found this out 2 days ago, okay? I asked why there wasn't, I asked a teacher in English why there wasn't any novels that I've seen recently. I said, in this grade, isn't there some, she wrote me back, they're going to read To Kill a Mockingbird next week. And I said, well, school's almost over. She said the reason that they haven't had any more is there's not enough money to buy the books in the school to provide for all the kids. I said, you've got to
be kidding. Right, but you can probably afford football helmets.
Right. I mean, for $100, I could buy, for the whole class, I could buy books.
Right. You know, our schools are there to churn out pawns, basically, to work for big corporations. I totally agree with you. I think it's a sad state of affairs. But let's face it, the schools today are financed by corporations, you know. Coca-Cola pays a lot of money to have those machines in the schools and have the exclusive rights. Nike pays a lot of money to have the Swish on athletic gear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes all down the line. We're training people to become pawns for corporations. I totally agree with you on that. And incidentally, addressing the other comment, it isn't that Milton Friedman created that theory. It's that he wrote about it. But it is the predominant driving force behind world capitalism, what I call predatory capitalism. The only responsibility is to maximize profits. It's not one man's theory, but it is the driving force behind the corporate world today. And we've all kind of, in a way, bought into that. And I think that that's one of the most important things that we have to change, whether it's the way we write our tax laws, which, again, say, let corporations maximize profits. Let's not tax them. And so on and so forth.
Yep, I hear you. Well, we got to kind of cut it off because I know that we had a certain amount of time with John Perkins, his book, Hoodwinked, and, of course, he's the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And also, I know, John, you have a lot of things that you do also on the charitable side. Why don't you mention a few of those?
Well, yeah, I'm a founder and board member of Dream Change and Pachamama Alliance nonprofits that really work to create a new paradigm. You can go online, dreamchange.org, pachamama.org. Also, please go to johnperkins.org and sign up for my newsletter that comes out about twice a month, and the most recent one to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. I'd love to have you Twitter me at economic_hitman, and I'm on Facebook, so I'd love to keep in touch with all of your audience out there, and I really truly believe that we are at a time in history today that opens this incredible opportunity for us to really change the world and use the world's resources in a much more productive way, a way that my grandson, who's 3 and a half, will be proud of and look back and say, thank God my grandfather and all those other people took a stand, and this is the time for us to really take a stand.
Yeah, I hear you, and I agree. I you talk about your grandson and all that, and it is a question. I think, though, by the way, I always think, oh, it's going to be hard for them and all that. I bet you that our grandparents thought the same thing, although their life seems so easy compared to ours, didn't it? But
it was a very, very different world then.
Yep. It's the internet. It screwed up everything. We're too connected. It's Facebook. Anyway, John Perkins, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Keep up your good work.
Thanks so much. John Dvorak, I'll talk to you real soon.
Chat.
All right, bye-bye.
Yep.
Well, that was kind of interesting. I mean, you have the whole idea that there is this corporatocracy. I don't know if you're buying into that or not, but I think it's kind of interesting. I'm not quite sure if, I know John Dvorak doesn't really necessarily agree with this, but if the whole idea of Coca-Cola in the schools and the concept that they're there to secretly build their company. Of course, they're going to sell soft drinks and they're going to build their company that way. But is it much more than that? Is it much more than just simply sales to people who enjoy and buy their drink products and their various food products? Is it the idea that they're getting them addicted and then bringing them into the fold to then be drones that are drinking Coca-Cola, producing Coca-Cola, selling Coca-Cola, and on and on and on? You can take it from there. I don't know. It's a little bit thin for me, but nonetheless, it is something that I guess there's a lot of people that do find some interest in. So check out that book, Hoodwinked. We have all the information about how to get in contact with him and his various websites on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and it's over in the show notes for this show. Just all you have to do is go over there and simply click on the show notes, or right at the top of the page, when you get right to the homepage of thedisciplinedinvestor.com, you'll find that information. All right, so, I mean, by the way, I'm sure we'll be talking about this on DH Plugged, Unplugged as well on Tuesday. So, you know, you'll get that on Wednesday. We'll have some discussion. If you have anything you want to ask me about that or tell me about it or comment about it, just send me a note at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com as well. So before we started the discussion with the Johns, we were talking about how all these things are happening right now in the markets and the tone of the markets. I want to start with the top. I want to start with the Fitch headline that we saw this week on Greece. Now, the main issue in Europe is simply that the European Union is dedicated to protecting their single currency. We know that. And we have seen a dramatic increase since the lows of the euro back at about 118 to about 145.6 it was for a little while, back down to about 141 and change, off about, I guess, about 6% from the high. This is moving very quickly for currencies. Now, the currency, you have to remember, is all about a relational value. So the relational value that we look at when we look at the euro is right now to the dollar, and simply that the dollar also has been losing a lot of value. So we're not really sure. Can you really pin it on the fact that the euro is gaining in value due to investor sentiment, the quality of the economics in the region, and the backdrop of the European powers that be in the IMF are going to backstop the euro, and the fact that they have been talking continually about inflation, raising rates, etc.? Or is it simply just a move out of the dollar into anything else? Now, at the end of last week, the beginning and the end, by the way, there was two sides of it, right? In the beginning, we saw a big drop of the euro. Then at the end, we saw another big drop, about a percent on Friday, because two things happened. Fitch downgraded Greece, but more so, they took a really hard line up. And I'm kind of proud of what they did, or happy with what they did, because this whole discussion about reprofiling their debt, a soft restructuring, has been floated around. You know, we've talked about this before. The idea that these leaks will go out there. We talked about this with Andrew Ross Sorkin last week. These leaks will be let out to see the reaction of the markets, and then they will act and change and maybe provide another leak. Now, of course, from an anonymous source, right? To see how the markets will react to the information and then maybe make fine-tuning adjustments or large-scale adjustments, depending on the reaction. So this discussion of reprofiling, whatever that means, or a soft restructuring or a lengthening of the time it takes to repay the Greece debt was talked about. Now, Fitch said, you know, here's the deal. We're not only downgrading you, but if we see a lengthening of the time it takes to repay. So if it was a 30-year bond that you sold, well, now it's going to be 40. If it was a 5-year bond, now it's going to be 10. That is going to be considered a default. Good for you. Good for you, Fitch, because it's getting a little bit ridiculous how they're just going around and around and around and around, just simply trying to bamboozle the investors, trying to create this atmosphere of confusion in order to continue keeping up the confidence. Somebody's got to tell them, we're not confident in what you're doing. Your plan of austerity and your deficit cutting mechanisms have not done what they're supposed to do. It's been a year since the promise of the first bailout was put into Greece, and yet their debt ratios are ridiculously high, and the repayment potential is ridiculously low. At the same time, we saw Italy downgraded, at least to a negative watch by Standard & Poor's. And I think the piece that really clinched it last week was something that happened that really was behind the scenes. There was a discussion from the Bundesbank in Germany that they see a much softer economy in the next number of months and next year. One of the reasons they said that was that much of the growth that they've recently seen and experienced was due to a lot of backlogs and order fills, and the growth that came in the last several months really is not going to be there because the order fills have been made and new orders haven't been really coming in as much. Now, here's what's interesting about that. If you think about what's going on, right, we're talking about the European zone has said that they're considering increasing rates. They're considering looking at inflation as a really bad situation, and they're taking a really hard line on that. They've already done some increasing. But now what's happening is that all of a sudden the diamond of the region, Germany, is saying, we see some slowing coming down. Now, Germany's hands are tied because they're not going to be able to actually provide any stimulus through rate reductions if the entire zone is seeing inflation and they're talking about the potential for raising rates. Raising rates will continue to slow down Germany and cut off some of the growth. So now you have the real heart of the exporting region in Europe who is talking about a slowdown, but the zone itself talking about choking off a little bit of growth because inflation is getting too hot. That's why there was, on top of the Fitch downgrade of Greece and S&P's downgrade of Italy, which actually came on Saturday, but that's why you saw the movement down in the euro, because now really there's a lot of confusion about not only the ability for the European zone to handle the Greek situation, but moreover, this concern about what's going to happen with Germany and the inability for them to do much. So they're locked. They're not going to be really able to raise their rates. And without being able to raise rates, they no longer have the benefit of the extreme strength against the dollar. That's a long-winded discussion that I want to have with you, but that's really important to recognize because right now there is such an incredible amount of investors and speculators that are on the side of the short dollar trade moving into the euro or anything else, particularly commodities and risk assets, that if we see this euro dropping significantly and the dollar rising in value comparatively, we're going to see a tremendous sell-off in commodities, and we're also going to see a pretty good sell-off in stocks, individual stocks and markets. There's no two ways about that, because the traders are going to have to get out of their positions very quickly when they reach that point of they have to cover their shorts on the U.S. when it starts rising, and they're going to do it very quickly, and they're going to sell all sorts of liquid assets to do so. Leverage is close to the highest it's been to since 2007-2008, and therefore the compounding effect of this situation is going to be even more difficult, and that's why you'll see these almost sell at any price numbers and situations go on. Now realize that one more thing that happened on Friday that was very interesting was that even as the dollar moved higher ever so slightly and the euro started dropping pretty hard, commodities sold off very hard. Oil was down 2%, gold was down 1%, silver was down 1.5%, etc. By the end of the day, even though the euro kept on dropping, dollar started rising, gold was up 1%, silver was up just a little bit, but oil and crude was up about 0.75%. Gasoline was up 2.5%. Why? Well, there's kind of an interesting scenario going on. It's not just simply the dollar move. It's also the concern about the sovereign debt and the potential for a sovereign bankruptcy or a sovereign default. And that's why individuals who are looking for options are looking for assets that are backed by something. So we have a very strange, concept going on where you have so many things that are tugging on each other that it is really causing this concern. On top of that, we saw the Gap, Aeropostale, JCPenney, Sears, a lot of companies coming out with good numbers in the retail sector, but there has been a margin squeeze, something we've talked about for a while. Gap in particular went down about 15 or 17% on Friday. They came in with an okay number, but the outlook was miserable. Their margins were tight, moved down substantially, and they blamed it on cotton and employment costs. Also, shoppers weren't spending as much, probably due to the fact that gas is so high in price. You had the same thing, a very similar thing, in Aeropostale. There were some outliers there, of course, but really of note was that the higher priced luxury items have been doing much better. And that goes to the discussion of foreign investors, foreign buyers that have this great opportunity to buy goods from the U.S., particularly at the high luxury price level, the high price level with luxury items, have gotten a great discount, 15 to 16% discount in some circumstances. So when you look at what's going on, you see also tech starting to drop off because of supply chain issues. We heard from AutoNation that they're really having a problem getting cars now due to the situation in Japan. And then on top of it, we've got to talk about Apple. Apple is clearly something that you want to watch to recognize market direction and sentiment. Almost every player out there owns a piece of Apple. We did till a couple weeks back. Apple, great company, great products, great revenue stream, great earnings potential, great balance sheet. You can go on and on and on. So that's why when you see Apple starting to roll over under its 50-day average, when you see Apple starting to show a lot of signs of distribution, you need to pay attention. And then when you see things like the HP earnings, which were miserable at best, and they're talking about the corporate market being very soft or very good, but yet their consumer market being very bad, and then you see Dell coming in with their same discussion, but Dell's numbers were much better. They saw a real uptick. Not to mention the fact that, of course, nobody had faith in Dell, but HP's price is somewhere back to where it was in 2009. These are all signs that you need to be looking at in a corrective market when you see high volume distribution days. You look at the Russell 2000, again, under its 50-day average, and you're seeing, more importantly, the 50-day average start rolling and sloping lower, breaking through important support points. These are all leading areas to look at. And then you have to look at, of course, the fact that QE2, or at least what we know now, isn't going to continue. The first one is to roll over oftentimes in a market correction, and not to spook you that it's going to be something, you know, drastic, but in a correction, whether it's a 5, a 7, a 10, a 2, a 9, whatever it is usually the more growth-oriented stocks, tech and retail. Oftentimes the first to come back are tech and retail. So we're seeing the leading edge right now of this happening. We're seeing the breakdown of the high quality stocks. No, we're not seeing a breakdown of Netflix because nothing breaks that down, you know. But aside from that, we're seeing a real concerning tone to the markets right now. Then we saw LinkedIn. Did you watch that? Did you watch that IPO? Priced at $45, which was above what everybody thought was the reasonable valuation. Open up at 80-ish. Fly up to 122. And closed that day somewhere about, I think it was 97. Opened up the next day, went up to 10 or 8, and then came back down to 94 again. Obviously, this is going to lead to an incredible race for many of the other social media stocks, like a Facebook or a Groupon, and the others, that to really go out there and try what they can to get as much as they can right now, because that is incredible. The amount of revenue that they have and the potential they have at LinkedIn compared to the price is a little bit far-fetched. It was reminiscent of 1999. The float was very small. The amount of shares they let out was very small, so it created an incredible amount of pressure, either up or down. That's why it moved so fast. And it did move fast. I mean, it was moving at $50 to $1 a clip. So I think that these are important signs when you see the gasping moves of certain stocks, but the rotation and then the rotation out of the quality stocks into the more defensive stocks, that's important. When you see Goldman Sachs at the low for the year, when you see the financials so weak, these are all things that you need to keep in consideration and be careful not to really load up on growth-oriented stocks. That doesn't mean you can't have high-quality stocks. That doesn't mean that they're going to fail miserably. But just be careful. Hedge your portfolio. Right now, we are short the Russell 2000 as a hedge against some of our better long positions. But you know what? Two things. One, we're not going to stay absolute with the Russell 2000 right now because there is still a lot of money in the system. If it pops above its 50-day and then moves beyond the next level of resistance, you know what? We're going to clean that position and then reset it either long or short, depending on the market movement. The second thing is that are long positions or are short positions, whatever you want to look at, but the long positions, we're not going to hold on them till they just totally break down and move away from us to a point that's, you know, bye-bye. We're going to set our rules and we're going to, you know, execute. So the other things you need to look at, I think, in this whole environment right now, aside from the whole situation of China tightening, the Middle East issue, I don't even want to talk about President Obama and what he talked about with Israel last week about going back to the 67 borders. I just don't even understand it. It really needs to sink in more, and I need to understand if he really meant that. But the Middle East situation, and then on top of it, you have the European financial crisis really starting to open up a little bit more. But you have some of the economic indicators in the United States, like the Philly Fed, that was just atrocious. You had initial claims higher again over the last several weeks. Dropped down last week, but higher again over the last several weeks. You had the leading economic indicators coming in much softer than anticipated. And that, again, is setting up the environment of be a little bit more cautious right now. So a lot of that I really wanted to kind of go through because I get questions all the time. I got to talk about international, this international emails I got, but I get questions all the time of, Andrew, where's this market heading? Where are we going? You know what? The market's going where it's going. Right now, a lot of the excess movement in the market is due to two things. Number one, earnings and excess liquidity. So you have some real opportunity for upside for those stocks that really perform. But even so, we saw things like Aruba Networks get just totally slammed last week when they had reasonable numbers, beat expectations, and their outlook was okay. It was down 15% after the earnings on Friday. Initially, it popped up, I think it was like 4% when the earnings came out, and then it just slid down for the rest of the day. Also look at what stocks are moving. If the ones that are moving are the crap stocks, the lousy balance sheet, the lousy earnings, you know that the playing that's going on is more like day trading. The traders are using those stocks as vehicles to make money versus the investor. Let me just get to this. I had a lot of emails come in. I want to mention this. I don't know what it was about last week, but it was International Email Week. And by the way, we have a lot of listeners around the world, Japan, Germany. I know we have a lot of listeners in South America and throughout areas, not only United States, but throughout Europe. So hello and thank you for, by the way, being there. And I appreciate you joining in and telling your friends. There was some questions about, you know, why, I guess I mentioned this a long time ago, but that we couldn't have clients come in for our strategy that lived in England. Well, there are some rules by the SEC. We can't take in clients from Canada, as strange as that sounds. I think it's strange. It has nothing to do with us. It has to do with the regulatory laws of the United States that investment advisors cannot have Canadian clients. I guess there's, I don't know what it is. It has to do with money laundering. It has to do with whatever it goes by. And then there is some issues with areas like England and some of the other areas in the Middle East. And, you know, you can imagine the countries out there. But the good news is that if you do have a question and you want to know if your country and your residency and your citizenship is available for investing in our strategy, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, just drop me a note, send it over to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com or go to our website, do the virtual tour. There's some information in there. But there are, we were able to open it up to certain English from England, I guess we would say citizens. There's residency issues and depends on where you live. I mean, we have people that live in Japan that have residency in the United States or citizenship in the United States, but have residency in Japan and so on and so on. So if you're interested, just let us know what's going on with that. All right. And last thing, I guess that we want to really address, I just want to mention to you is the, I want to go back to the area of Apple for a second. There was an explosion in the Foxconn plant last week. There's been some concern about distribution. Will they be able to get their products out? But more so, I saw a great chart that showed the percent of iPhone and smartphone sales around the world comparatively and the different, you know, players that are out there. It looks like to me that Nokia has been losing share. We know this, but look, Nokia has been losing share over everybody. Nokia and Research in Motion, losing share to anybody else. Apple has taken a tremendous amount of share. Android systems have also taken a pretty good share. But Apple is really, if you look at the chart, there's a gigantic bar up for Apple. Everybody else is either kind of, you know, slowly moving higher, or on the other hand, you have Nokia and Research in Motion, and Nokia more so, that's moving down. I want you to realize that this still remains a extremely good growth area, and the Apple effect on companies like an Atmel, or you look at the chip providers like ARM Holdings, ARMH, and even Intel when it comes to the chips inside of their computers for the Apple laptops. The carriers, the antenna providers, I mean, and so on and so on and so on. You can go on and on and on. The camera companies like OmniVision. Look at these companies, because I think that when this market does break down, they're going to probably break down, if that happens. We're looking as though it's going to. And when it comes back, these are going to be some great plays, because these are going to be the ones that are still have the opportunity because they're so hot. So when the market does come down, we know virtually everything comes down, just across the board, no matter good, bad, or, you know, ugly. Some will come down more, some will come down less. Some will hold up better than others. Small caps will probably lead the move down, and then, you know, you get to the quality, and then they start breaking down. But look at some of these companies, because I think that they're still going to continue to be the leaders, and they're going to be the opportunity, especially when you see some of the manufacturing pick up. And if there is alternative needed to the iPhone, to other phones, to the iPhone, I think you're going to still consider those very, very solid. So anyway, we'll leave it at that. I think that's enough with the Apple discussion. Goldman Sachs, I mentioned, Carl Levin after them. And what else? Oh, so much going on. But next week we have Jack Schwager coming up. I mentioned that to you also. And I think we want to just go over that. I was looking at what's called the Bloomberg Orange Book, which this is input commodity prices and discussions that are held by retailers. And the top of the list was clearly the concern about the costs. You know, Sherwin-Williams comes out with a discussion that, given the recent upward trend in polypropylene prices and aggressive pricing actions taken by the raw material suppliers, they're going to have a real problem with their earnings and seeing some issues there. This is done by Richard Yamoran, Yamaroni from Bloomberg. And I've spoken to him a few times, actually, and he puts this together. It's just great. He talks about Whole Foods, and they say that the competitors are raising prices, and it looks to me that 1% to 2% in the last quarter is pretty much the pricing increase that's going to be going up. Obviously, that goes for all sides. You're going to see pricing inputs increase as well. So whether or not we have inflation or not, you know, you look at things like Dean Food in their conference call. They're saying that continue a volume picking up and then eroding throughout the end of the month. And they're saying that people are just running out of money. They just don't want to spend the extra pricing right now. Kellogg's saying that you're going to see increased prices for grains over time. And we would probably look at 2012 and say, yes, it's probably going to be inflationary. How inflationary? We have to wait and see, and the supply and demand shakes out and where the prices shake out from there. So between Colgate and Procter & Gamble, Safeway, Kimberly-Clark, Ingersoll Rand, company after company are talking about the pricing pressures that they're seeing right now. The problem is going to be with the pricing pressure they have. If they can move product, that's great. But many of these retailers are going to start to see a slowdown if, in fact, the economy starts to slow, consumers slow down, gas prices stay high, and the input prices stay up. The one caveat, if they can pass on prices right now, and if we do see a drop in commodity prices, these companies are going to be poised to really do well. Because now they have the embedded prices that people are willing to pay. They've already looked at their profit lines and projections and put them into practice for the future, utilizing what they anticipate would be the price, but yet the prices go down. It's kind of the opposite. Their margins will go up. So we have to look at the overall cost factors right now, I think, to see really what the future is going to hold. Right now, margins will stay compressed from everything we're seeing right now, particularly in the companies that are food-related and clothing, cotton-related, and those that have anything to do with rubber and certain metals and all. If we do see that reversal, it would be very good. If not, you know what? It's going to start getting a little ugly. But the good news is really that as prices go up, people will consume less. And that is an automatic, semi-automatic, I guess, stop to any price increases that we see. Because if you don't have the supply and demand going on, if you don't have the demand against the supply, you're not going to see the prices increase. Seems logical. We'll see if that holds up. Anyway, thanks for joining me. We'll end it there. And I look forward to seeing you next week. Send me a note, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And again, thanks to all the international listeners out there, wherever you are. I do appreciate it. And I do enjoy the fact that you write me on a regular basis. And if I wasn't clear and we weren't clear before, yes, we can take in a lot of international investors. So check it out. In the meantime, have a very profitable week. Watch for some of the economic indicators that are coming out next week carefully. We'll be tracking them on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Make sure to bookmark that site where we have analysis of economic indicators, stocks, overall things that may kind of be present in the market conditions from Europe to the Fed that you need to know at all times. Again, thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.